Do you want to host a precision rifle match, but you only have 100-yard range? We talk about the National Rifle League 22 matches this week on Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and this is Mail Call Mondays, the show that answers your questions about precision rifles, optics, and equipment. Welcome to another Mail Call Mondays, and this Monday we are going to talk about 22s. This last Saturday was my first ever National Rifle League 22 match out at the Westside Sportsman's Club in Evansville, Indiana. And this is a first for 22 rifle matches in Indiana. This is the first 22 NRL match held in Indiana. And through the month of September, you'll see these matches held all over the U.S. in various different locales. Now, I've been really, really excited about the National Rifle League's 22 matches because they really open up precision rifle shooting to a whole lot broader audience. A lot of people don't have access to a 500 or more yard range, and shooting precision rifle at 100, 200 yards is really difficult when you're shooting center fire rifles to actually make it hard enough to spread out the field without really killing some people. So the National Rifle League set up a 22 match format that utilizes a 100 yard range. So if you only have access to 100 yards, this kind of shooting is for you. They also broke down classes into base and open classes, the two main equipment classes, so you further limit that down to people being able to get into the sport with a very low cost to entry versus what you would see for a regular centerfire precision rifle match. So we're going to cover some questions regarding 22s and the NRL 22 match format in specific, but we are also going to talk about the rifle that I shot sitting here in front of me, my 10/22, and we'll go over some equipment and some other issues about the match itself. So without further ado, let's get on with our first question. Our first question comes from Andrew from Patreon, and thank you, Andrew, for being a Patreon subscriber. If you guys want to support us on Patreon, we'll leave a link down below where you can check that out. Andrew asks, can you please go over all the equipment needed to host the match, the equipment needed for the attendees, and the rules to the match? Well, Andrew, that's one of the really cool things about the NRL 22 matches is the equipment needed to host the match is fairly limited. Whereas to get into hosting a centerfire precision rifle match, you have to have quite a bit of steel targets. They're rather expensive, and you have to have a large area to set those steel targets up, and then you have to maintain those steel targets because they will get beaten up and broken throughout the match. For the NRL 22 matches, first you need the NRL 22 target package, which is a steel target package made by JC Steel Targets, and it runs about $250, and you can pick it up on the NRL's online store. That has a couple of different swing set type setups, a little mini Know Your Limits type rack, and some gongs and target stands for the gongs. And because we're working at shorter ranges, the targets can be smaller, they can be lighter, you can throw them into the trunk of a regular compact car. You don't need to have a huge amount of space or a big trailer or a pickup truck to carry them around. We're making it easier for people that are closer to urban centers to be able to shoot this kind of match. In addition to that equipment, the NRL specifies you'll need a couple other pieces of equipment that you can pick up at a local hardware store, like a stepladder, some buckets, some cinder blocks, that kind of stuff. And they have recommendations on the website for exactly what you need to get. So for a couple $100, you can really get everything you need set up to go. They also have some paper targets for some of the stages, so you'll need some way to post up paper targets, but most ranges already have that available. So the equipment is fairly simple. Now, the equipment needed for attendees, if you're just coming to watch the match, you just need eye pro and ear pro. Obviously, you need eye protection for this kind of match because you are shooting steel targets and you're shooting steel targets relatively close. So whereas a lot of guys see eye protection as optional for center fire rifle matches where we're shooting at long range, I kind of look at eye protection for this kind of match as mandatory. Also, if you're standing off to the side of the line and you're spectating, there is the possibility to catch splatter off of one of the targets, off one of the target stands or something, and get a little bit of something in your eye. So it's really important to make sure that you do wear eye protection. Now, for shooters, the equipment list is fairly short for shooters. In addition to your eye and ear protection, you need your rifle, depending upon which class you're in, depends on how the rifle will be set up. I recommend a bipod. You will need a rear bag of some type. Now, most of the stages only allow a rear bag smaller than the size of a volleyball. So if you picture a volleyball, your rear bag has to be that size or smaller. I also recommend a sling. A lot of us had spotting scopes, but spotters aren't really needed. They were just kind of nice for when you're not actually on the gun shooting and you're spectating. You can help spot, or you can go look at the paper target that you just shot and see how you did, and that kind of thing. You're obviously not doing a whole lot of spotting wind or spotting trace with 22 rifles, so a spotter really isn't necessary. It's just kind of one of those extra pieces of gear that's nice to have. And that really is about it. Your ammunition, and you need a 10-round magazine. The courses of fire are only 10 rounds, so one 10-round magazine will do for you. But since I was running a semi-auto, I made sure I had two 10-round magazines. That way, if I had a malfunction and had to eject a round, I could just dump the mag, reload with a fresh mag, and not have to worry about trying to get a 22 bullet that was rolling around in the dirt cleaned off and back into the magazine. So that is about it on the equipment requirements for the attendees. Now, the rules, we'll get a little bit deeper into the rules as we go on. And in fact, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to break this episode up into two different parts. We will go over the questions and the setup of the gun and that today. I think I'm going to shoot a separate episode that goes over each of the five courses of fire of the match from this weekend so we don't make this episode too ungodly long. Our next question is from Andrew, and Andrew asks, what are some basics to consider when building a Ruger 10/22 to compete in this type of match? Magpul versus Titan versus Bell & Carlson stock, different barrel makers, different triggers, or optics? Also, if I already have a Magpul Hunter 700 on my 6.5, would it be more worth it to keep a Magpul stock on the 10/22, or would any of these stocks be fine since they are all traditional type stocks? Well, Andrew, first of all, the things to consider about a 10/22 in this match is, first of all, like any semi-automatic rifle in a match, you want it to be dead reliable. So you need to make sure that you find ammunition that functions with the rifle. Now, the class that you want to compete in will depend upon how you configure your specific rifle. If you want to complete in the base class, which a 10/22 will work in the base class, then there's pretty much not anything you can switch out on it. You can put a comb riser on the stock or a cheek riser on the stock. You can put whatever scope base you want, whatever rings, and whatever scope that falls under that $700 price range to remain in base. But that's basically it. You can't change out the trigger, and the trigger on 10/22s I don't think is the greatest trigger for target shooting when it comes right out of the box. I think it needs to have a little bit of tuning done. But if you change anything out on the trigger, that bumps you out of the base class. One big drawback to the 10/22 that I learned this weekend shooting it is that the stock bolt lock on here is not easy to release quickly. You have to pull back on the bolt handle, and then you have to fiddle with the lock and get it down, and then you can release it. Sometimes it works relatively quickly. Sometimes you have to fiddle with it a couple times to get it knocked down out of the way so that the bolt can go forward. If you switch over to an auto bolt release, I believe that will kick you out of base class. I'm running in open, so I'm going to go ahead and do an auto bolt release on this so I don't have to deal with that going forward. And modifying the factory bolt release to an auto bolt release, my understanding is really not that difficult. It's just changing the configuration of the notch on the actual bolt release itself. So we'll play with that a little bit later. But there aren't a whole lot of things to think about in base. Now, if you go into open, then running a different barrel is fully within your class and a different trigger, and I definitely would recommend a different trigger, and then you can swap out your stocks and everything. Now, barrels, sky's the limit, but the Green Mountain barrel that I have on here is working really, really well. I do wish I had gotten the threaded barrel so I could run a suppressor on it. A lot of guys were running suppressors at this match. NRL allows you to run a suppressor even in base model or even in base class. But I definitely would prefer to have a suppressor on here just for the fun of shooting it really, really quiet. It was nice when the other guys were shooting suppressed rifles that everybody could take their ear pro off and just relax, and all you're hearing is just click, click, click as they're shooting rounds down range. So suppressors are really a nice thing to have for this kind of stuff if they're legal in your area. Now, on your stock question, Magpul versus Titan versus Bell & Carlson. Really, for accuracy, I don't think it's going to matter for you. I did notice something really interesting with the Bell & Carlson stock here. It does have a barrel pad up here at the front of the stock, so the Green Mountain barrel is not fully free-floated. It's free-floated back through this part of the forend, but there's a pad right here at the tip that the barrel's actually resting in, and that takes some of the stress off of the receiver. Since this is a factory receiver, you don't get that barrel droop that you can sometimes get with factory receivers when that barrel bore has gotten worn out a little bit. But what I did notice is when I drove this thing like I drive a centerfire rifle, which means I have the bipod loaded hard into something, and then the buttstock is hard in my shoulder, and I'm relaxing my body weight into the rifle, I think I was getting a little bit of flex in the forend that was allowing the barrel to droop just a tiny bit. And that was enough to throw me off about half a mil at 100 yards. So half a mil at 100 yards, it can make you miss an entire MOA size target at 100 yards. So a 1-inch target, you can drop bullets right under it. So that's something I have to experiment with a little bit more. But when I figured it out, I was able to stop that, and then I had no problems with it after all. The Titan stock, the 1022 Titan from Victor Company, it is actually fully free-floated up here, so there shouldn't be any part of the stock actually touching the barrel, so that may alleviate that, and I'm going to play with that stock a little bit more and see versus the Bell & Carlson how that works. Really, the reason that I'm running the Bell & Carlson instead of the Titan is the Bell & Carlson is just a chunkier stock overall. It's got a little bit more weight to it, and it makes it feel like a more substantial rifle. However, I do like the shape of the Titan 1022. I like the shape of the pistol grip. It's really more vertical. I am running the Victor Company comb riser on this stock as well as on the Titan. It works on both stocks as well. So that's a really nice feature to have. Now, since you're already running a Magpul Hunter 700 on your other rifle, then the Magpul 1022 stock may be a really good option for you, because that's going to transfer those ergonomics over, and mounting the stock, it's going to feel exactly the same. So if you really like that Magpul stock on your 700, I would recommend the Magpul stock for the 1022. You're still going to get a free-floated barrel. You're still going to get all those benefits, but you will, again, have the same ergonomics between the two, and I think that's probably more important. And then lastly, optics. The optics issue, I have really been hunting to try to find what optics are available in that base class. Now, obviously, when you go to open class, the sky's the limit. So if we're talking about open class, the biggest thing you have to make sure is that that optic will dial down to 25 yards for the parallax. If you can't focus sharply at 25 yards, it's not a good scope for what we're doing here. I was running the SWFA SS 3-15x42 in front of me. This is a first focal plane scope. It does have a mil reticle. It has their mil quad reticle in it. It is a 3-15 power. So 15 power, I thought, when we went out and we were shooting the paper stages, I thought 15 power was just a little bit on the low side, but it was still workable. I really would have preferred to be able to go up to 20 power for the paper stages. But again, when you start to get into that higher power, you see a lot of those scopes don't focus close enough on the parallax side of things. So keep that in mind. I am running a mill-mill setup here because it means I only have to think about one drop table. I don't have to think about MOA and mills. And there were quite a few times when I just held for my elevation because I was worried more about working the parallax knob than I was about dialing my elevation in. You don't need a ton of elevation if you are going to stay at that 100-yard line, but if you're going to stretch out and you want to be able to shoot the same 22 at 300 or 400 yards, which it's really fun to go out and shoot a standard velocity 22 at 300 and 400 yards. If you're going to start doing that, you need to make sure you have a decent amount of elevation on your scope because that 22 is dropping like a rock at that distance. So think about those kind of things. Now, if you're trying to stay in base class, your scope needs to be $700 or less. So the SWFA SS 3-15 is like $699.95. So it really maxes out the price range for base. But again, I've got it sitting on an open rifle, so it's not a big deal. If I really wanted to, I could put a Night Force ATACR on this thing. And who knows, I may throw the ATACR on it for the next match, just for grins, to be able to go out and roll out with a 10-22 with that level of scope on it, just for the fun of it. Our next question comes from Frank, and Frank asks, what are some differences you noticed, if any, in equipment slash gear between centerfire and rimfire matches? Any difference in suggested training? Does match 22 ammo have any measurable advantage over any other ammo, or is it better to try several types slash brands to find what performs best in your rifle? Were there more factory actions or custom actions at your match? Well, Frank, the differences in gear between centerfire matches and the rimfire match that I went to are pretty significant. For almost all the stages, you could only run bipod and a rear bag or a sling. So you can't go out there with six different bags to build a position with. You can't go out with a bag on your gun, a bag on your arm, a bag on your knee, a bag behind your head, and a pillow underneath your butt and shoot. You can do that during a lot of the centerfire matches. So there was a significant reduction in gear, and I think that's a good thing because, again, it will be less for new shooters to have to buy to get into this sport. So, again, bipod, I had two different rear bags that I brought. I brought the Short Action Precision rear bag, and then I brought a straight-laced bag that I used for the fore-end. I could have used the Short Action Precision bag for the fore-end on one of the stages and just stuck with one bag. So really, you did not need that much gear. You don't need range finders. You don't need all this other stuff. Of course, I always bring tools to be able to maintain or fix my rifle if I have problems with it. But that is about it. So the gear is definitely at a minimum. Now, the suggested training, one of the reasons that I really like these 22 matches is the training for the matches are pretty much the same. You're going to be shooting positional. You're going to be shooting off of barricades. You're going to be shooting under time. You're going to have to build your position behind the rifle rapidly and get your shots off. So that's where I see this as a really great opportunity to get some more training in that will work for long-range centerfire matches. So really, the training between the two is very, very similar. The only difference is you'll be working the parallax turret a whole lot more on the rim fire than you will on center fire. Center fire, very often you can get away with setting your parallax at a midpoint down the array of targets and then just rolling with it. Here, if you're switching between a 25-yard and a 75-yard target or a 25-yard and a 100-yard target, you have got to adjust that parallax. Otherwise, you're going to have all kinds of problems seeing the smallest targets. Now, 22 ammo, that is really a sketchy topic because I shoot 22 Wolf match target. I found that it is a very good option. It works really well in most of my precision 22 rifles. It runs reliably in the 10-22 and it is very accurate. However, what you need to do if you have one rifle and you're trying to figure out what the best ammo is for it, you need to buy several different types of ammo and shoot that ammo through the rifle and see what ammo it groups best with. You may find that the cheap bulk ammo groups very, very well in your rifle and you don't have any reason to buy match ammo. But on the flip side, you may find that all that bulk ammo, it just really doesn't like it, or it causes malfunctions or any other nonsense, and the match ammo is the only thing that will shoot well in it. This rifle shoots much better with match ammo than it does with bulk ammo. When I say much better, I mean more consistently. You may get a nice group or two with bulk ammo, but then, you know, it may open up from there. You may get a flyer here, a flyer there. Whereas the match ammo, the consistency from cartridge to cartridge is much, much better. So that's why I stick with the match ammo, but that doesn't mean your rifle will function the same way. So definitely go out and test it. There were guys that were shooting the match this weekend that were just shooting bulk ammo that worked just fine in their rifles. There were guys that were shooting target ammo as well. So it's all over the board. You just have to find out what your rifle likes. And as far as factory actions or custom actions, most of the actions that I saw on the line there were factory actions. The exception may have been one or two of the 1022s may have been running an aftermarket action, but I didn't get close enough to inspect each gun to see if any were aftermarket or if they were just stock 1022 actions that had been modified like mine here. But we saw quite a few Savages, quite a few other guns out there. Bolt actions were still the primary action of choice, although I think there were three or four of us that were running semi-automatic rifles. So still at the club level, I think you're mostly going to see store-bought 22s. I don't think you're going to see full custom 22s other than the 1022s because it's just so easy to build up a full custom 1022 right now. But as we go on in this sport and we start getting more full custom 22 actions, I think you'll see more of those going forward. I'm really liking the Voodoo 22 action. It's a 700 footprint 22. I really want to get my hands on that guy, drop it into a full-size 700 chassis and see how well that works. But I haven't seen any of those showing up at matches yet. But again, this is the first month for them. We'll probably see more as we go on. Our next question comes from Jeff, and Jeff asked, does using a semi-auto give you an advantage over a bolt action? What distance were the targets, holdover or dial for elevation? Well, Jeff, first of all, I don't know that you got a great advantage overall between the semi-automatics and the bolt actions. The time limits for each one of the stages was 120 seconds. 2 minutes is a lot of time to get off 10 shots, no matter what the shooting problem that you have. The semi-auto didn't give me a great advantage in that aspect. Now, some of the position shooting, being able to just hold the rifle there and fire shot after shot after shot without actually having to change anything, that was a little bit of an advantage. And again, when we're talking about a bolt action 22, the throw is so short and the cocking action is so light when you have to lift that bolt that you can run a 22 bolt really, really fast. So again, not a huge difference between the two. The reliability will generally go to the bolt action rifles. However, I did see a couple of malfunctions with the 22s. So it's overall, I think it's a wash. I like the semi-automatic. I think on when we start to get into faster stages and lower time limits, I think the semi-automatic is going to shine. But that shouldn't have you looking for a semi-automatic to go shoot these. Bolt action will do it just fine. As far as distances to the targets, closest was 25 yards, and the smallest target at 25 was a quarter-inch circle on a swinger. So that's pretty small. And then out to 100 yards, the smallest target at 100 yards was a one-inch gong at 100 yards. That pretty much gives you the bookend on difficulty, the most difficult close target and the most difficult long target. And then there was a mix in between, but you usually shot at 25, 50, 75, and 100 yard lines. So if you're setting up your rifle, make sure you have your dope for those specific yardages and you should be good to go. And lastly, yes, holdover or dial. And I did a mix depending upon what I needed to shoot. Most of the time I was holding over if it was switching yard lines quickly. If we were just shooting on 1 yard line, like when we were shooting the paper targets, then I would dial and leave it there. So it's important to have a reticle that will allow you to do both. I especially think it's important to have a reticle that you can use to hold over if you are going for a less expensive scope, because using that reticle and holding with the reticle, once you've verified the reticle and learned the quirks of the reticle, then that is going to be more accurate than dialing a scope turret that may have a lot of lash in it. It may not be very accurate adjustments, or it may wear out over time. So utilizing a holdover reticle will probably work better in those circumstances. And we'll talk more about optics that are oriented for this as we go forward. We may break that off into its own video because I'm actually still researching the topic as far as what optics are available for the base class, which really puts that $700 price limit on your scope. Our last question comes from Carlos, and Carlos asks, do you see NRL 22 attracting new shooters or as an additional channel for those already interested in participating in PRS-style matches? Well, Carlos, actually, I kind of see it as both ways. For guys that are already participating in PRS matches, this utilizes a lot of the same fundamentals, a lot of the same skills, so those guys are naturally going to gravitate towards this kind of shooting. However, the guys that their dance card is full with PRS style matches maybe are not going to be so much inclined to pick up another discipline in addition to their primary one. Where I really see the big benefit is the NRL 22 as a gateway for new shooters to get into the center fire precision matches. I can see them getting into the NRL 22 saying, hey, you know, this is great fun. I can get in with a lower cost platform. I can do a lot of shooting off of barricades, off of positions, moving, that kind of stuff. Get used to that kind of format and then say, hey, maybe I want to push my distances out a little bit more and then look at investing in a platform to shoot the PRS style competitions. I really think the NRL 22 is a great gateway in the fact that it is less technical than a PRS style match. PRS matches, you need to know how to calculate your dope. You need to be able to calculate your wind drift. You have other things that you have to think about that are more technically intensive than what you have on an NRL 22 match. Now, there may be, if you're shooting on an open range without tall berms, you may get some wind gusts where you have to hold for wind, but there's not a whole lot of calculating going into it. In fact, you don't need a ballistic calculator. You don't need to really be able to do any math. You just need to go out and staple up a target at 25, 50, 75, and 100 yards, shoot your rifle at the target, and then note what you had to dial on your rifle to get to each one of those stages. Environmental factors are at a minimum at that point, so it's really just about your ability to record data and then utilize your rifle as well as you possibly can. So I think there is less of that fear of what you don't know going into an NRL 22 match versus going in to a long range match. So I hope that it will get new shooters into these matches, and then as they progress and as they get comfortable shooting that match format, maybe start looking beyond and start looking more at the PRS matches. But I really see NRL 22, if it continues to pick up momentum, as being its own thing and an end to itself. You'll see guys going in and souping up some serious platforms just to shoot open class NRL 22. So that's where I see that going. Now, let's take a few minutes and let's talk about my rifle here in front of me. And I'm going to talk about some interesting points on the NRL 22 rules. This is a factory Ruger 1022. It came from the factory as a carbine, which means it had the pencil barrel. It had the carbine stock, the wooden stock with the barrel band at the front and the pretty severe drop at the comb. Pretty much the only thing that remains of that original rifle is the receiver, the bolt, and the trigger housing. Even the guts of the trigger are a little bit different on this now. Starting from the front, this is a Green Mountain 20-inch barrel. It is their bull barrel, and it does have a target crown. Now, if I had to do this again, I would get the threaded crown, but this barrel was on sale when I picked it up, and it was just it was an easy solution to get it and thinking I was going to have it threaded later on. The reality is it cost me about half of what a new barrel would cost to get this precision threaded for a suppressor. So I don't know if I will or won't do that. I like having suppressors on 22s. It was great listening to them shoot at this match. You could take your ear pro off and you're just hearing the click of the striker lighting the round off. It was not loud at all. It was actually pretty humorous to sit here and watch a click, bolt cycle, and not really hear the bang and the crash that you're used to with centerfire rifles. Now, as we come back, this is a Bell & Carlson stock. It is one of their fiberglass stocks, and it does have a little bit of heft to it. And I really like the profile of the stock. It's got this nice butt hook here on the back to help hold it. It's got a more vertically oriented pistol grip, which is nice on target rifles. It helps you get that straight back pull on the trigger. It's got a relatively flat forend, so it works well on barricades. It works well on putting bags on it. Has two front sling studs, so you can run your bipod on the front, and you still have room to run a sling between the front and rear stud on the bottom of the rifle. Nothing extra, nothing fancy. It's got just a regular rubber recoil pad. No flush cups, none of that stuff. But I did add a Victor Company cheek riser to it. It's just got two screws that screw down into the stock here to hold the riser on. It fits perfect on this stock, and it works very well. That's the one drawback of the stock is the comb is just a little bit too low for a scope, even when you're mounted on low rings. So you need to bring that comb up just a little bit, and this worked great. The scope base, I believe this is a Weaver scope base, but it's been a while since I purchased it, so I can't recall exactly who manufactures it, but it has worked just fine. For this competition, you really don't need a 20 MOA base. A flat base will work just fine. But if your scope's got the adjustment in it, a 20 MOA base will allow you to go out and shoot those 300 or 400 yard distances if you really want to have some fun with your 22. I do have a kid charging handle on here. It's just a little bit more pleasing, a little bit larger than the factory charging handle. And the kid charging handle assembly allows you to swap out different recoil springs to tune the bolt action or the action to your ammunition. So that was kind of nice. I'm still running pretty much the stock weight spring in here. I haven't gone through and done any tuning yet, but I mainly picked it up just because I liked the contour and the size of the charging handle. The trigger in here is a Kid trigger kit. It is set right now at about 3 pounds, just a little over 3 pounds, and that is as low as I can get it just putting the parts in that Kid supplied and their lightest trigger return spring. To me, that is still a little bit too heavy for this because we are working with a very lightweight gun. It's not as lightweight as some 22s, but it is very lightweight compared to a centerfire rifle. And I did have some issues when I tried to free recoil it off of a barricade, even just pinching the trigger guard and the trigger. I still had to apply enough force that I was inducing vibration into the rifle. I wasn't able to just get that shot off quickly and ended up having to ditch the whole idea going free recoil and driving the rifle into the barricade instead. So I would definitely recommend if you have an idea to do stuff like that, go with a lighter weight trigger. Most shooters that are new getting into precision rifle shooting would think this is a very light trigger though. It has a very nice quality to it. It breaks very, very clean, has minimal over travel. It does have over travel adjustment stops and it has no pre-travel at all. So again, it's a very nice trigger. I just want it a little bit lighter. So I am going to play with it a little bit and see if I can tune a pound or two off of it there. Now, I'm going to talk to you about the NRL rules real quick between base class and open class. If you go to the NRL's website, they have the rules posted. And when you go down to classes for the base class, what they have posted is the base class is intended to be budget-oriented. Any rifle with an MSRP of $350 or less qualifies for base class. Scopes used in the base class must have an MSRP of $70 or less. Now, That is just for the overall system. It goes on to further say, no modification of any kind may be made to the factory trigger or action. And they also include aftermarket barrels, triggers, including trigger spring kits, or any other parts that modify the factory barreled action are not allowed. So basically, for a base rifle, as long as your base rifle comes in under that $350 limit, you can put a cheek riser on it. You can put whatever scope base on it you want, whatever rings you want on it, and whatever scope that comes in at $700 or less on it. And that is pretty much it. You can't modify the stock. You can't modify the barrel. You can't start to go into all this other stuff. So comb risers, length of pull, that kind of stuff that you need to fit the rifle to the shooter. But nothing beyond that. So going in and starting to polish your trigger and clipping coils on springs and things of that nature, that violates the spirit of the game. Now, realistically, at a club level match, they're not going to break your rifle apart and check to see if you've Dremeled on your trigger or cut coils off your springs. But again, it's spirit of the game. If you want to do that stuff, just go ahead and bump up to open, and open is unlimited. Do whatever you want to do to your rifle. But if you're going to shoot in base, let's stick with the rules of the game. Now, one interesting loophole, though, on the base class, if we scroll down here to the bottom to their amendum, they say the base class limits the MSRP of the rifle at $350. Many of the different grades of rifles from the same model are just different grades of stocks, but the quality of the barrel is confirmed by all manufacturers to be exact same. Therefore, if a rifle's model line has a model below the MSRP of $350, all models are acceptable. So if one model is under $350, then you can choose any of the models to shoot in base class. And they have a specific approved base class rifle list, and that includes the Ruger 10/22, the Savage A22, B22, 64, and Mark II, and several other ones. But the two most popular that we're going to concentrate on are the 10/22 and the Savage Mark II. Those will likely be the most common rifles that you'll see show up at base class. Oh, and one other thing that I will include here, they do have one specifically excluded rifle from base class, and that is the CZ-455. We did see a couple of CZs. The CZ-455 is a great rifle, but if you choose one, you cannot shoot in base class. That is automatically bumped to open class. And right now, I don't have the exact reasoning on that. I haven't researched the CZ-455 to see if there was one that was under $350, but I am assuming that the majority of their models are beyond the price point, and they just wanted to clear up anything on that. But specifically talking about the 10/22, the 10/22 carbine is without a doubt underneath the base class price limit. You can roll into stores and pick those up for under $300. However, the 10/22 target model is significantly above the base class. Now, according to the current NRL rules as of September 2017, the base class, you can shoot the top end 10/22 in the base class since it is specifically allowed for base class and since one of those rifles falls in the base class model. I don't know how I feel about that. I think that is starting to open up a pretty large loophole, because if I was going to buy a 10/22 to shoot specifically in NRL, I would probably go ahead and buy the top-end Ruger 10/22 target. It's going to come with a heavy barrel. It comes with a heavy laminate stock that's a little bit larger, a little bit better fit to adult shooters. You can still drop a comb riser on it. You can put this scope on it right here, and that rifle will shoot 90% or 99% of what this will do. I just have a better trigger in this than would come on that rifle. So you really have to be careful about that kind of stuff. The Savage Mark II, I think that's a little bit less of an issue because the mid-grade Savages are still pretty close to that price point. Now, if you go to one of the upper grade threaded barrel Savages that have the Boyd stock on it. Those are above that base price point, but I think that's a really good bolt action rifle to shoot in base class if you were going to go that route. So just keep that in mind, and if you show up to a NRL 22 match shooting in base class with a 10-22 carbine, and you see a guy shooting next to you in base class with a 10-22 target model that's all blinged out, that is the reason. As long as he's not changing anything that's prohibited in the rules, you can shoot the 10-22 target in base class, even though it is above the base class price limit. So that's really the biggest strange thing in the rules, and we will leave a link to the full NRL 22 rules down below. I'm also going to leave a link to the NRL 22 course of fire for September, and we will hopefully shoot a episode here shortly covering specifically the match and the 22 course of fire. We had some technical difficulties when I shot this episode the first time, and we had to actually ditch all that footage, so I'm trying to work on a little bit of a time limit here and get this shot edited and out to you on Monday, and we will probably have the course of fire explanation and my after action report from the match on Tuesday. That is the plan right now. Sorry if this episode seems a little bit disjointed, but again, I'm trying to rush to get it out. This is the second time that I've shot it, so my brain is going into a little bit of vapor lock trying to remember what I covered on the first one and what I'm covering on the reshoot. If you guys have any questions or comments on my Ruger 10-22, the NRL 22, the match, or the rules, please go ahead and leave them in the comments section below or send them to us on Facebook or Twitter, and we will try to answer them as best as possible. If you're listening to us on podcast, you can send any questions you have to 8541tactical@gmail.com. I want to thank you guys out there that are Patreon supporters. You're really helping us out to keep this thing going. We've got some new equipment coming in for the camera, and those Patreon donations really help us take care of some of the rather expensive equipment that we use to produce this show. If you've liked this show, please make sure you like, share, and subscribe. And until next time, get out and shoot.